I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we continue our conversation from earlier this summer on how to build a more inclusive concept of well-being around the world. Today, we talk to three global experts who've teamed up with the world's lead thinkers on this subject to develop new concepts of a more inclusive notion of well-being. Dr. Tim Lomas is a lecturer on positive psychology at the University of East London. Tim, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Luis Lambert is assistant professor at the United Arab Emirates University. Luis, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
And my old friend, Dr. Jim Harder, Gallup's chief scientist for workplace management and well-being. Jim, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me again, Muhammad.
So as we're all sitting in this COVID relative immobility, depending on where you are, I want to first ask you all about your own personal experiences meeting in Kyoto to really sit down with the world's lead thinkers on well-being and explore what dimensions aren't currently being captured in a lot of the metrics the world depends on. So who among you, which brave soul can sort of take us to Shunkoin Temple and remind us what happened in Kyoto?
That feels like ages ago. I know it was really, really hot, but for me, it was hugely refreshing in the sense that it was just great to be in a room with non-dominant Western views. And I didn't realize how different that would feel until you're in a room and you suddenly go, oh, this is not the usual narrative that we typically hear. And then coupled with that, being in this beautiful temple, being out in literally the forest, it was very hot. It was very humid. We did some meditation. We had some fantastic food. We were surrounded with magnificent people. It was really quite magical. And I'd never been to Japan, so it was like, wow. It really added to the magic for me.
Yeah, it was such a beautiful experience in so many ways, in every way. Like Louise, I'd never been to Japan before. Somehow, because I'd always wanted to go, and for example, I've been into Buddhism for 20 years and somehow contrived never to make it to Japan, and it was kind of everything I would have hoped for, and it was just an incredible experience. It was a beautiful setting, and the people, you know, was such great minds and so original, and we just had these incredible discussions, and as well as kind of delicious meals and kind of incredible kind of sightseeing opportunities. It was just a really kind of magical few days.
I would contrast it with the first time I met the organizer of this. His name is Yoshiki Ishikawa. He came to Omaha, Nebraska. I think it was in January during a snow blizzard. And we met for a great day of discussion. We were trapped inside. And then several months later in August, in the heat of Kyoto and the beauty of Kyoto, all the green, and having worked on Gallup's World Poll for the last 15 years, to hear the contrasting views in comparison to what we've been measuring. And we've had regional experts in Asia, of course, over time, but to hear an intense discussion about what might be missing and what we can add to make it even better than it's been in the past, I thought was really good. Including on our committee, a Buddhist monk, very down-to-earth guy, Tonga.
That's awesome. Tell us a little bit about sort of the structure of the summit, the topics that were tackled. How did you all even agree on topics to tackle?
So I think, first of all, what I really appreciated, you know, wasn't experts talking at one another, but it was more just very casual conversations. So we all started just basically presenting, here's what I research, here's what's interesting to me, here's, you know, certain angles from particular cultures or wherever we were from that we felt very passionate about. And that sort of opened up the conversation. So if I recall, that's really where we started, is just having these, again, very intimate conversations. So we were a very small group. It was not hundreds of us in a big room. We were probably less than 20. We were all sitting on the floor, as you do in Japan, drinking tea and just chatting. And for me, I think that was the interesting piece, is you're hearing all these different views from all over the world, but at the same time, you're also really getting an intimate view on kind of the inner workings of researchers and why they research what they do, but also the frame, the worldview that influences why we research what we do and how that influences the questions we ask as well.
Mm. Yeah, it was a very nice structure because, as Louise said, each of us there, I think, gave some presentation into our own work. And I'd say probably around half the participants were from outside Japan and the other half were from Japan. And we each gave a presentation, but not like a lecture, more like a seminar. So even from the start, it was a kind of a process of dialogue and discussion that animated the whole process. And just sharing ideas and perspectives. So in relation to each one of our own projects, we would hear what other people, what their take would be and what their perspective would be. So I think from recollection, that was the first 2 days really. And then, as you can imagine, the discussions would carry on like late into the evening and into the night. And we would, it was just this kind of, you know, incredible atmosphere of, you know, dialogue and debate and sharing ideas. And then to the final day, we had this structure really in terms of moving forward, trying to develop these new items for the Whirlpool. I think I can recall that in the morning it was really selecting topics, and then in the afternoon we moved on to having selected the topics, trying to formulate these as items, and that was just an interesting, a really interesting exercise in itself.
Yeah, I think
Jim, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I feel like the themes that we ended up with sort of naturally emerged from the ongoing conversations, both during the more formal sessions and the informal dinners, and the themes around balance and harmony and calmness as an emotion versus, you know, some of the traditional ones we've measured, like stress and worry and sadness and happiness, and the relationship of the individual to the group, collective versus individualistic, and making those kinds of contrasts. I thought it was a very, very good natural process. And then we had some good debate about questions as we got into that. And I thought we had a very democratic process in terms of getting to the topics. We actually voted.
It was very democratic. We each had little pieces of paper and, you know, scorecards. It was very democratic. It was very beautiful.
it really was fascinating because, you know, Jim mentioned this concept of balance and harmony, which turned out to be, I think, one of the pivotal ones. And it was really interesting because I think perhaps I did, initially would have this preconception that was somehow perhaps synonymous with a low arousal emotion, like calmness. But actually, we started to really tease them apart in interesting ways, and balance and harmony, not just being about feeling at peace or tranquil, but really can apply across all different areas of life. So, I mean, work-life balance is one example, but this could apply across different aspects of life and trying to find a harmonic way of living as a whole. So, and I think that was something we arrived at through these discussions, because it's not, balance and harmony aren't things that particularly necessarily well conceptualized or well studied in the literature. So it's almost like we were trying to find our way to what these really could mean based on everything we were hearing from people's perspectives.
And that's what's fascinating to me, that, you know, at this late date, you know, in 2020, we're still in a place where so much of the literature really is still very Western centric. And even if it's created by, it's research done by people who are not Westerners, researchers, experts, they're often doing it at Western institutions. They're often publishing from a Western academic source. Just reading, and of course, there was a wonderful paper that kind of captured a lot of these dimensions that you all worked on. And I'll mention the title of the paper towards the end of the conversation for those interested. But just reading through some of these, it's so powerful. So one is relationship to nature. I feel connected to nature and all of life. Or mastery, I am capable of dealing with life's challenges. Jim, you thought about how to ask citizens about well-being across the world for 15 years now. What were some of the most kind of compelling learnings for you in terms of how you capture how a life is lived in a more inclusive way from this work that you did with these folks?
Well, in our past World Poll, we've, of course, we've tried to maximize kind of the understanding of the two selves. So we've got the evaluating self. We all can kind of sit back and reflect on our lives and rate how our life is going in general. And then the experiencing self, which is more about what we, the emotions we experience on a daily basis. So we've learned a lot about those two extremes, but there's another component called eudaimonic well-being that we've tested in the past, but we haven't found really good questions outside of our workplace measurement. We haven't found really good questions that differentiate people. Like, for instance, we asked people about whether they had purpose and meaning in their life. And across the world, we had just really high endorsement of it, but didn't find a lot of differentiation. So to get the kind of wording that we need to get at that eudaimonic component, I thought was really important in this particular, because we had a chance to really think deeply about it and think about Eastern conceptualizations as well. And so eudaimonic meaning the concepts of growth and meaning and self-actualization. And so I think we've pilot tested some questions, and I think we're a lot closer to getting there than, and we'll know once we get the data back from the World Poll, but I think we're a lot closer to getting at some good measures of eudaimonic well-being to offset some of the other measures we have.
Luis, I want to ask you, you're sitting in Asia now, you're in the UAE, you've been there for 10 years now. So it's really kind of your new home. What among the dimensions that you all tackled did you feel you can kind of see happening around you in the cultures and the societies that you've been teaching and learning from?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that I see, I think, is the emphasis on the I. So in the West, it's much more individualistic. It's I do this, I do that, I make my decisions. It's much more of an active agent. And here in a collective society, there's less of emphasis on the I. So I did a couple of qualitative studies asking my students, for example, you know, what were their sources of happiness, comparing that to other nationalities that I was working with at the time. And one of the interesting things that I noticed was the absence of the word I in their answers. So they would say things, when my parents are proud of me, when my family tells me I do a good job, when I can help my brother. So it always referred to somebody else, but it was that gaining happiness through others. And so that is not typically very well reflected in much of the questions that we ask. And it puts people at a disadvantage, because if you ask questions around a sense of agency, I am happy with the decisions I make. I have taken action today on A, B, C, whatever that is. And it's not to say that people don't here, but when you focus on that agent, the sense of I, the individual, people here might be less likely to endorse that. And by default, they end up looking less happy. But that's not necessarily the case. So if we worded it differently and said something like, I am happy when my parents are happy, if we have a bit of a deferral agent, then the scores may come out a little bit more evenly. So that's kind of one of the things that I wanted to see included. And I guess time will tell what the happiness results will look like as a result. But it was something that needed to capture that the majority of the world is, in fact, from collective societies. That is the norm. And yet our measures would tell us otherwise, because the measures come from the West. They stem from the US, which is an individualistic culture. And so we just kind of assume the rest of the world is that way. But in fact, it's not. We're the odd ones. we being the individualists, that's not normal, actually.
And that's most captured, I just want to say, from the study and from the effort you all is relation to group. My happiness depends on the happiness of people close to me. It really captures that concept. Tim, you were going to say.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting point that Luis is making, and this notion of, you know, Western, the constructs we tend to use being rather individualistic. If it's life satisfaction, it's do I feel satisfied with my life? Do I have positive emotions? And it's acknowledging that there's other ways of thinking about construing happiness and well-being, not simply the fact that, for example, the key determining factors might be the happiness of other people around us, but actually trying to think of happiness in different ways. So you could think of the happiness of a group or of a place to the extent that, you know, you aren't taking into account other sentient beings, even the kind of the environment surrounding us in what we think of as being well-being, to the point that could we even experience well-being if, for example, the environment itself wasn't flourishing? You know, and this obviously connects with the item around relationship to nature. It's obviously so crucial at this time with climate change and unfolding around us. So almost moving to I don't say moving to, because I do think the individual conception has its place, because we do want to think also, are people themselves doing well and happy? But then I would say augmenting that with a kind of broader, I guess, multidimensional, holistic perspective. So not necessarily to replace the individual one, but to augment it, to recognize that there's different perspectives and ways of understanding well-being in its kind of broadest sense.
Why is it, let me ask all three of you this question, why is it important to measure well-being beyond, of course, just knowing that somebody is doing better or worse, or beyond an individual wanting to know how they're doing on a particular sort of well-being assessment? On a social level, why is it important for us to measure well-being and have these metrics?
I think there's a number of reasons there, and I'll defer to my panelists to add a little bit more. But I think for me, it's important to measure because then we can track it. And we can spot when happiness reports come down, when they go up, but also to backtrack and understand why that is the case. So what are the factors that are contributing to it and or undermining it? You know, we know from a couple of years ago, looking at the World Happiness Reports, measures of negative affect, but also progress. So when you only look at GDP, it looks like countries are doing really well. But had we backed up, or had governments backed up and actually looked at how people were feeling about their lives, they might have noticed that people were actually very unhappy despite governments or economies doing much better. And some have suggested, actually many people have suggested, this was one of the precursors to the Arab Spring. So we need to track happiness. How people feel matters. It's not just a soft, fuzzy variable, but that's all of life. If you're not happy in life, what is the point? And governments need to keep a tab on that.
And I think it affects people's decisions. So to have global standards is really important. Like, for instance, even on life evaluation, we've seen it predict all kinds of societal unrest as a precursor, that even beyond, much beyond, and oftentimes signaling something very different from what, as Luis mentioned, GDP might tell us. And so I think we have to always be thinking about, from a well-being measurement standpoint, what's actionable and at what level. We know at an individual level, you know, that both policies and individual decisions can affect as much as half of our overall well-being. And so we've got to equip people to know, and leaders to know where society's at, and then individuals to know where they're at personally. And organizations, I've been working on this a lot lately, how do we help organizations think about what they can do in this current environment? It's even more important. And I think well-being measurement is going in the direction of from nice to have to essential, and something that organizations can't live without in the future if they want a resilient workforce.
Because I think you're right, with the kind of scholars and organizations involved in this kind of work, I think there's kind of multiple motivations. On the one hand, we just want to kind of understand happiness better, but there's actually a strong, I guess, applied element, you could call it, where we're really interested in actually trying to help people be happier, or, you know, organizations are interested in trying to help their members be happier, and governments, perhaps their citizens. And I think it's obviously important for these kinds of policies and decisions to be data-driven. So, for example, we see the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and I think this is kind of strongly based in the work that Gallup and others have done in terms of what matters to people, what matters to their well-being, and then based on that, trying to develop, you know, goals and agendas and policies based on that.
So what are the next steps now with this effort? I know that you all have planned on some pilot testing of items. How do you move forward with a summit in 2020? How are you all still continuing to tackle this despite the challenges we're all facing with COVID?
Well, I've got to say, you know, I've been working hard this year in the context of the pandemic, and I think Gallup have been very kind of, you know, nimble and resourceful in adapting to the situation. So I think much of the testing this year with the items that have been included in this year's waivers been through telephone interviews rather than face-to-face. So they've done a remarkable job really of keeping the data collection going in a kind of safe and ethical way. So we're getting a lot of data in from the items we've included in this year's poll. So on the one hand, we're going to analyze those, but at least for the next few years, we're trying to pilot different items because, you know, we included 9, but there were others we were interested in asking. For example, the question around relationship to nature, we weren't able to include in this wave. So it would be nice to perhaps try and include that in the next wave. And I think we have this process over the next few years of retaining some items, but also piloting new ones. I think with the aim of around 2023, having a kind of core set of items that we're happy with. So it's really still an ongoing phase of, developing new items, still thinking about new perspectives and topics, and trying to pilot these through the World Poll.
And any thoughts, plans for a next summit, perhaps a virtual summit?
Well, we do. I'm going to let Louis say about that because we do have one coming up in October, which we're all very excited about.
Well, I was going to say we need to get through this virtual one. And then I think like everyone, we're going year to year on plans in terms of meeting. But in October, we're going to be having a virtual summit and we've got talks scheduled, some recorded, but again, it will be reflect very much the initial intent in Japan, and we'll try to mimic that as much as possible. But sorry, again, having these conversations, probably feedback from the initial questions, and trying to plot out the next direction in this context.
Jim, yeah. You want to hit some?
Well, yeah, I think this is very much we're testing questions. You know, all the questions we're using right now, the 9, have been through cognitive interviews in regions around the world. So we know that they have a good chance of making sense to the average respondent. And that's always the challenge in this kind of work, is getting measurement that makes sense to people in a generalizable way. And so we have to keep the question wording, simple, translatable. We've gone through all those steps, but when we get the data back, we're going to learn even more because we'll be able to see which ones are working, which aren't. We've got a few versions of each different concept that we're looking at. We mentioned some of them earlier, like balance and harmony, calmness and peace. And there's some different iterations of items that we're testing for each of those. And I'm just excited to see the data, and then that'll start new dialogue, new discussion, and it'll be an iterative process. But this is the kind of thing that's very exciting to me personally. Because the learning and growing part of this work is non-ending. I mean, it's always hard work to measure how people feel about their lives and then to see how that relates to other meaningful outcomes.
So the paper I referenced is called Towards a Greater Global Understanding of Well-Being, a Proposal for a More Inclusive Measure. It's a great short read on this effort. That is, of course, sponsored by Wellbeing on Planet Earth Foundation, which is based in Japan. Folks, your closing thoughts on how we can pursue well-being in this COVID insanity that we're all living in 15 seconds. Who wants to go first?
Prioritize and align our research agenda with the Sustainable Development Goals, because if we do not have clean air, if we do not have equality, if we do not have jobs, well-being is incredibly difficult. So I think by prioritizing sustainable development, we can maintain and sustain a global happiness.
I would totally agree. And then just add to that, really just trying to encourage a kind of spirit of dialogue and collaboration and conversation across the world. Because I think, Wellbeing for Planet Earth, the foundation, have done an incredible job in setting up this global wellbeing initiative. But it really is this evolving work in progress. And we obviously initially focused on Japan and the Eastern context, but I think their reach and their scope, their ambitions are far broader in terms of, we really want to have this dialogue with people across the world, and not simply as us as academics studying them, but just in conversation and dialogue and co-production and collaboration, really to try and be as expansive and inclusive as possible. So I think that's something worth aiming for, even just beyond this project, but just for the world in general, you might say.
I think continuous dialogue, I agree with that, Tim, and with leadership, share the data with them and have some continuous discussions with leadership. I think we'll learn, as we have in some of our other work, that there are certain variables that just matter a lot more. You think about even the relationship to group, and how that, how we have to do different kinds of things as organizations and as society to make sure that we maintain the social well-being component during these times. So, I think all those things are really important. But the more dialogue we have and sharing data and thoughts with leaders and decision makers, I think that'll be a really important partnership.
Doctors Tim Lomas, Luis Lambert, and Jim Harder, thank you all for being on the show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That's our podcast. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe to the podcast from any podcast app, just search the Gallup Podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us at Gallup News. If you have questions, feedback, or suggestions on topics for future episodes, we want to hear from you. Write to us directly by emailing podcast@gallup.com. This Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus. And this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.